Although it's a staple of springtime these days, Mother's Day has a long, complicated, and hard-won history. It started in spirit as part of an impassioned movement to end the bloodshed of civil war. Mothers hoped that by working together they could prevent the loss of their sons through violent conflict. Fast forward to the early 21st century and the fight for recognition of Mother's Day resumes in West Virginia. The scrappy history of Mother's Day plus a local writer reflects on pregnancy.
I felt disconnected from you. I said awkward things while I was pregnant, like, it's the size of a grape. He or she is the size of an apple. Now it's as big as an artichoke.
It's all about Mom on Central Standard right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman and today we're talking about Mother's Day. Now, if you think this is just a holiday invented by greeting card companies to capitalize on the impossible task of expressing our deepest, most profound gratitude, you could be forgiven for that. It's an understandable assumption. But Mother's Day has a real grassroots history that often goes untold. With us to share that history is Catherine Antolini, a professor of history at West Virginia Wesleyan College. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
So I was first intrigued by the history of Mother's Day when I stumbled upon the text of the 1870 Mother's Day Proclamation. It's an incredibly forceful document. Could you tell us a little bit about what it says and what inspired it?
Julia Ward Howe, the famous poet, the author of Battle Hymn of the Republic, and she was also a famous suffragist. She was inspired not just by the American Civil War, but particularly in 1870. She was upset over the atrocities during the Franco-Prussian War that was raging at the time, and it moved her to want to make this grand appeal to all mothers of the world to unite, and it was women's responsibilities as natural caretakers to fight to put an end to war. So in 1870, she issued what was known as the Appeal to Womanhood Throughout the World. It's commonly known as the Mother's Peace Day Proclamation, but it originally wasn't known as that. That comes a little bit later. But her idea was for women to form an international kind of, council in order to talk about bringing peace throughout the world. So that's in September of 1870. By 1873, she's realizing how ambitious that was, and that to get women to feel empowered, to be able to provide like a world voice, she realized you have to start at a smaller level. So that's when she starts promoting local Mothers' Peace Days, where she encouraged women to get together in churches and in their own parlors to talk about peace and hopefully building a larger movement. She actually selected June 2nd as her Mother's Day, and various peace organizations celebrated Julia Ward Howe's Mother's Day until about 1913, when it was eclipsed by the Mother's Day that we celebrate now.
Where did Julia Ward Howe live, and what was it about her own experience that you think propelled her to make this effort?
She was in Massachusetts. Again, she lived through the Civil War and saw the atrocity of that, and then her interest in European affairs. And she also lost one of her own children, so she knew the grief of losing children. She saw death all around her. I think it was just a part, also that time period of this belief that this view of women, because of our experiences as mothers, being kind of distinctly different from men, and that we have, we really know what it means to lose our sons. We brought them into this world, and to have them slaughtered on the battlefield was simply an atrocity. And women should be the ones, as children, women protect their babies, and they don't want to raise them be slaughtered on the battlefield. So she felt women had a responsibility to protect their children, especially if they're going to grow up to be sons, to be used in war.
Was she able to round up like-minded women to rally behind a pacifism rooted in motherhood?
She was. And, I mean, these her celebrations were mostly celebrated on the East Coast, Boston, Philadelphia, honored it every year, Chicago. It was also celebrated in groups in London and Rome. So it did have kind of an international flair to it. So it was was important to her to have the, sometimes in the United States, it's also referred to as the Women's Peace Festival. But to her, it was an important first step for women to feel empowered. Like they could come together without the help of men. They could come together and solve problems that obviously men were incapable of solving.
Any sense of how the men in her midst received her declaration of anti-war sentiment? I mean, did she have that impression that there was something uniquely female about the ability to solve this problem? And how did men respond to that?
Well, again, these are her Mother's Day was primarily celebrated by pacifist groups. So they were eager to have women be part of the movement. And eventually what's going to happen, however, and this is kind of a sad tale with Julia Ward's Mother's Day, she envisioned her Mother's Day where women would lead it as mothers and empowered mothers and would solve these kind of global issues. By the early 20th century, when the other Mother's Day movement starts, the language starts to change, and so you have these pacifist groups who start pulling back the role of women and say, yes, women, you do bring forth sons, and you want to raise them to be pacifists. But they started to really dial back this idea of women being leaders in peace. So Julia Ward Howe really saw women as being mothers, as being leaders. By the early 20th century, male-led pacifist groups are trying to kind of rein that back.
And that's interesting to me that she originally saw Mother's Day as a day that led by mothers to solve problems, as opposed to a day where children express gratitude to their mothers, who are
right.
Sort of on the receiving end of the active part of Mother's Day.
That's the difference between the Mother's Day movement led by Anna Jarvis, which is Mother's Day we celebrate now.
Well, let's get into that. Later in the show, we'll hear a reading of that original Mother's Day proclamation, Mother's Day Peace Proclamation that we heard about. But for now, let's move the story forward because it takes a few more people championing this cause, right?
Yes. Well, actually, Mother's Day has many, I guess you want to call them foremothers and even one forefather. So there were several different people who are often given credit for coming up with the idea of Mother's Day, but Mother's Day we celebrate today, the Mother's Day that we're honoring, the national centennial of that, was a movement started by Anna Jarvis, who never got married and who never had children of her own. So for her, Mother's Day really was a day where children celebrated their mothers. It wasn't mothers being empowered because she was never a mother herself. So she only saw motherhood through the eyes of a daughter.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And her mother, didn't her mother also play a part in leading a Mother's Day movement of a kind?
Right, right. So Anna's mother, Ann Reeves Jarvis, was very active in her own community. So Ann Reeves Jarvis was a mother of 13 children. And
that was 13, I'd like to reiterate.
Yeah, 13. And she only four of them lived to adulthood. So she buried her first child when she was all of 21, and then buried her last of children to die when she was in her early 30s. So she, you know, understood the pain of losing a child.
And that was fairly common in this time period, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. So what happens in the 1850s, and by that time, Ann Reeves Jarvis has already lost two children. And she is organizing with other mothers in her community in what was then Virginia, what becomes West Virginia. And she wanted to get other mothers involved in stopping this, the kind of horrific infant mortality rates. And so she organized what were known as Mother's Day work clubs in the 1850s, where women got together and learned about sanitation and so how to stop epidemics and how to keep milk from being contaminated to stop what was known as summer diarrhea that killed toddlers. And doing their best, again, but very much in the same vein as Julia Ward Howe, as mothers being empowered to work together to make change. And so Ann Reeves Jarvis very much envisioned, she had hoped someday that somebody would establish a Memorial Mother's Day, but she very much saw it through the eyes of a woman who was a mother and knew that motherhood was more than just caring for your own child, but this kind of broader sense of social motherhood.
Right, because this sounds like a public health cause.
Exactly, right.
And how did her daughter kind of shift the focus? I mean, where did that interest on her part come from?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it is the fact that Anna Jarvis never marries or has children. So she just doesn't have that perspective that her mother had. And also, a big part of Anna Jarvis' Mother's Day movement was to justify her leadership of it. It'd be very hard to justify a movement to empower mothers when you are not a mother yourself.
Agreed.
So I always say, this is a day about sons and daughters celebrating their mothers. And she purposely did that to kind of, I think, to very much justify why this single childless woman was leading the movement towards a Mother's Day.
So is there kind of like a disagreement between mother and daughter that's ironically at the heart of this, the origins
right.
of this holiday?
Yeah. It's kind of it's almost symbolic in the difference of spelling. Anne Reeves Jarvis, Julie Ward Howe, and others who kind of saw Mother's Day as a broader social thing, often kind of refer to it in its kind of mothers and its possessive plural kind of spelling, where for Anna Jarvis, it was always possessive singular.
Huh.
Your mother. You're not celebrating everybody's mother. It's your mother because she's the one who raised you. She's the one who sacrificed, you know, dedicated her life for you. So she would always say anybody who was using the possessive plural spelling of Mother's Day were imposters and were not using it correctly.
This implies a very widespread understanding of grammar and use of apostrophes.
Yes, and the symbolic meaning behind it, yeah.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman, and here with me this morning to talk about the history of Mother's Day is Professor Catherine Antolini from West Virginia Wesleyan College. Later in the hour, we'll hear your tributes to your mothers on our weekly Tell KCUR segment, and we'll also hear a local writer's reflections on the earliest stages of motherhood. Stay tuned for that, but for now, Catherine Antolini, let's get back to the history of the holiday. Mother's Day wasn't officially recognized until 1914, when Woodrow Wilson gave the official proclamation. But we've already heard that an unofficial proclamation predates Woodrow Wilson's and that people had already been celebrating Mother's Day for a few years by that time. How did the beginnings of the celebration take hold?
Again, that is Anna Jarvis. She's the one who's going to establish Mother's Day celebrations on the second Sunday of May. Because Julia Ward Howe, her celebrations were in June. And so Anna Jarvis, she chose the second Sunday in May because it was closest to the anniversary of her mother's death.
But how did people in the general population begin actually taking that up? I mean, it sounds like we have these localized movements that are very specific to their own communities. And I'm just curious how it becomes a widespread phenomenon.
It's Jarvis. She starts a huge, massive letter-writing campaign in 1907. She's writing every governor. She's writing Teddy Roosevelt at the time. She's writing John Wanamaker, Henry Hines, editor of Ladies' Home Journal, Edward Bach, Mark Twain. She's writing any powerful figure, religious, political, business, that would help her establish this movement. And John Wanamaker, Philadelphia, being her biggest kind of benefactor. And so the first official Mother's Day celebration was in 1908. And in Grafton, that's why we kind of lay claim to it in West Virginia. And then in the afternoon of May 10th, 1908, was a much bigger one in Philadelphia. By the next year, by 1909, almost every state is celebrating Mother's Day, either formally because a governor issues a proclamation or informal celebrations within churches. So 3 years before Woodrow Wilson makes it a national holiday, it's already being celebrated by every state and territory.
How are you surprised that it took 1 year for it to go from being
in?
Really?
No, I mean, she just was that. I just had a conversation with a reporter from Yahoo, and we were joking how this is the woman who did so much before social media. She would have been unstoppable. because she had massive letter writing campaigns, and she did it every year. So it always bothered her when Woodrow Wilson got credit for establishing the day, because she's like, no. He just recognized the day that was already being observed. And also by 1912, she's also campaigning internationally. and she's claiming observance of Mother's Day are being held in South America, are being held in Canada, and she already, by 1912, has translated Mother's Day literature into 10 different foreign languages.
Did she? So right? She knew 10 different foreign languages?
Well, she had them translated.
Oh, okay.
For her. And she's promoting it, not just as a national movement, but as an international movement.
So we've heard a few different interpretations of what we're celebrating or what we're honoring in the about the purpose of Mother's Day. And do you think that maybe rooted in some of that difference is a different belief systems regarding women's roles more generally?
Yes. Yeah. And what's fascinating is you study how Mother's Day was used. All these different groups are going to use it, and some are going to use it for commercial purposes. A lot of charities kind of latch on to Mother's Day as social causes, as fundraisers to help maternal health issues or to help, particularly in the 1930s, it becomes an important day for charitable foundations start using it a lot. So all these different groups take Mother's Day and adapt it to what they need it to represent. So it's a very versatile holiday.
That still kind of happens today, don't you think?
Exactly.
Well, so speaking of how it happens today, when you look at how Mother's Day is celebrated now, do you see anything of its history in its current incarnation?
Well, I see less. Well, I take that back. I do see more discussion of maybe taking it back to its original roots with Anne Reeves Jarvis and Julie Ward Howe, those who saw it as a way of empowering mothers. But traditionally, we still kind of follow Anna Jarvis's model where you honor your own mother. Now, granted, she didn't want it to be commercialized. She didn't want you to buy flowers. She didn't want you to send greeting cards. She wanted you to go home and spend the day with your mother and celebrate her and everything she did for you.
Well, the relationship between the floral industry and Mother's Day, though, turns out not to be a recent one.
And that started right out of the gate. So, and Anna Jarvis actually initially reaches out to the floral industry and says, I'm trying to establish this holiday, and I'm using the white carnation as an emblem. Would you help me? And so she, I don't know what she was thinking. I thought maybe she probably thought that she could reach out to them and then kind of control them. And they just run with it. And she picked the white carnation for several reasons. But one reason was that because it was relatively inexpensive, it was for pennies, you could have gotten it in 1908. But then, you know, quickly it was raised within decades to a dollar. And she was just outraged by that. And so she attacked the floral industry for kind of, she called them infringers. She called them profiteers for taking her day. And the funniest thing about her, in the 1920s, she tried to undercut the floral industry by creating a Mother's Day floral badge that you could get for free from her association. And she wanted people to wear this floral badge and not buy live flowers. So she tries, but she can, to kind of go against the kind of commercialized trend of the holiday.
It seems like this really was a full-time job for her for many years to create this holiday and then sort of try to massage how it's recognized, how it's observed, who's supporting it, all of those kinds of things. And you have mentioned that she's a single woman without children herself. Do you have a sense of what was going on inside her that made this such a front and center issue in her life?
It was her life. That was her job. She incorporates herself in 1912 into the Mother's Day International Association, which is essentially her out of her own home. So it was very much a part of her identity as being founder of Mother's Day. And now her name is kind of lost. Unless you grew up in West Virginia, you know about her. But in her time, she was a kind of a celebrity. And that was very much a part of how she saw herself. So she did. It was her career. She did inherit money from her father, from her brother that helped her live independently. But she's going to die penniless. She never profits from the day herself. And she died with nothing.
Do you think that on some level she was maybe like a frustrated politician?
Absolutely. And it's so sad when, you know, all these reporters used to call her crazy. Crazy Anna, this crazy spinster who was, you know, railing at everybody and threatening to sue everybody, which she did. But to her, Mother's Day was her intellectual property. And she even claimed copyright on it. So that's another reason that she hated when people gave Woodrow Wilson credit for the day, because she didn't want Mother's Day to be seen as in the public domain. She wanted to still be seen as her copyrighted property. So that's why she threatened to sue just about everybody who used Mother's Day in a way that she did not agree with.
Do you think that in order to be sort of someone who's working toward change and toward establishing something significant society-wide, that perhaps the idea of motherhood was, I mean, was that maybe one of the few available to her to attach herself to, being herself a female?
Right. And a lot of time, too, I think an easy way, especially in that time period, to call her crazy. I mean, how many single women who were trying to live independent lives and trying to establish themselves were criticized for being crazy because of what kind of true woman would do that? So I think by labeling her a crazy aunt, it was a way to dismiss her and what she was attempting to do as a single woman.
In terms of the celebrations of Mother's Day that arose early on, what did people do other than going home to spend the day with their mothers?
It's always been a big part of church services, and she did that on purpose, too. She chose the second Sunday in May because she wanted it to be a Sabbath day. She liked to call it a holy day and not a holiday. So a big part of Mother's Day was with going to the church, and the church deserves, the Christian churches deserve a lot of credit for helping to promote the day and it spread, because it was just fit nicely with the kind of Christian idea of motherhood.
When do you start to see it transforming into more of a secular holiday?
I think by 1914, you also see it. Yeah, again, because by that time it's been celebrated all across the United States, and it's leaving the churches, and the floor industry has latched onto it, and it's becoming much more commercialized. So I think before 1914, before it's even a national holiday, it's starting to be more of the secular celebration.
When we look back on things like Julia Ward Howe taking up the cause based on not wanting mothers to lose sons to war, and then Ann Jarvis taking up the cause based on a need for sanitation to prevent infant mortality, and then her daughter Anna Jarvis taking it up out of a need for an expression of her own political and professional desires on some level, how do we see in Mother's Day moving beyond Anna Jarvis, maybe permutations of ideas about women and their role?
Well, today or this weekend, we always have a Mother's Day ceremony at what is known as the International Mother's Day Shrine, which is the museum where the first Mother's Day service in Grafton was held. And so this Sunday, we're talking about all who mother. So I think if we look at motherhood beyond the biological tie, and we see motherhood more as a social relationship, all women mother. Whether you're mothering your own children, you're mothering nieces or nephews, you're mothering members of a congregation, you're mothering neighbors, you're mothering a community. So yes, Anna Jarvis never had children, but she was a mother of a holiday. She was a mother of a movement. And so we're trying to celebrate that too, and how women, whether they are biological mothers or not, are touching and shaping other people's lives.
A lot of women might take issue with that characterization. Just I'm thinking about female politicians who get sort of called out for being matronly or something like that, like this idea that a woman in whatever role is on some level a mother. Do you think that the objections to that have any grounding?
If we're defining a kind of social motherhood as feeling obligated to help and serve others, isn't that what a politician should do? So why would that be insulting?
So there are different ideas about motherhood, and they're still being expressed in perspectives on celebrating Mother's Day today.
Right.
Well, we'll be right back to this conversation about the history of Mother's Day and more. Central Standard's going to take a short break, but we'll be back in a few. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this morning we're taking a different perspective on Mother's Day. Earlier in the show, we mentioned the Mother's Day Proclamation of 1870, and with us now by phone from Olympia, Washington, is an artist who created an artistically rendered print of that document. Her name is Nikki McClure. Hi, Nikki.
Hi there. Good morning.
How did you stumble upon this proclamation?
Well, it was an event that was being organized in our town to sort of bring it to light and think about Mother's Day in a new way. And it was a tea party that was being organized by these women in Olympia in 2004, I think. And one of them knew the great-great-great niece of Julia Ward Howe, who was going to be in town, and she, I guess, impersonates Julia Ward Howe. And she wanted to read this proclamation at this tea. So I thought, well, everybody should have a copy of that proclamation, and I thought I should print it up, and so I did so.
What about the 1870 proclamation resonated with you in 2004 so much that you wanted to invest your own creative energy into it?
Well, that time it was sort of we were 1 year into another Iraq situation, and it just felt like, you know, that as a feminist, and looking at this proclamation, really in 1872, sort of post-Civil War, she was asking for a council of a Congress of women without limit of nationality to be held to promote the alliance of the world and to sort of settle international questions. I'm kind of quoting from it even, and in the great and general interests of peace. And also, so there was that, but also I had newly become a mother myself, and so as a mother, now you enter into this other aspect of war, which isn't just, you know, sort of this economic or social or cultural side, but it's your actual body of your child could very well be part of war. And that's just horrific to know that you could be a part of it at that personal level.
Well, KCUR's Sylvia Maria Gross did a reading of the Mother's Day Proclamation by Julia Ward Howe. Why don't we listen to that now?
Okay.
Arise, then, women of this day. Arise, all women who have hearts, whether our baptism be that of water or of fears. Say firmly, we will not have great questions decided by irrelevant agencies. Our husbands shall not come to us reeking with carnage for caresses and applause. Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. We women of one country will be too tender of those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure others. From the bosom of the devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, disarm, disarm. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Blood does not wipe our dishonor, nor violence indicate possession. As men have often forsaken the plow and the anvil at the summons of war, let women now leave all that may be left of home for a great and earnest day of counsel. Let them meet first, as women, to bewail and commemorate the dead. Let them then solemnly take counsel with each other as to the means whereby the great human family can live in peace, each bearing after their own time the sacred impress, not of Caesar, but of God. In the name of womanhood and of humanity, I earnestly ask that a general congress of women without limit of nationality may be appointed and held at some place deemed most convenient and at the earliest period consistent with its objects, to promote the alliance of the different nationalities, the amicable settlement of international questions, the great and general interests of peace.
Wow, that's powerful stuff. That's Sylvia Maria Gross reading Julia Ward Howe's 1870 Mother's Day Peace Proclamation. Nikki, is there a line in there that particularly jumps out at you as maybe this year as Mother's Day approaches?
Yeah, the one that was this one is, our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we've been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. And that one strikes particular chord to me as I send my child off to school just prior to this. and, you know, it's a government school, public schools. And so sort of, you know, that is a tender spot right now for me.
So the idea of just saying goodbye to your child in the morning is kind of an idea of what will your son learn or unlearn?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And that you're trying we're trying to teach them charity, mercy, and patience, but what is there in the world right now that is promoting that, really, in some ways? And the work that we do at home, how can we as a society continue to make that work happen in a broader social kind of, you know, like school?
If you could choose how we celebrate Mother's Day today more broadly as a society, what would your preference be?
Well, there is a line to this, you know, that all women put aside the cares of the house and come together and discuss these matters. That actually sounds really amazing, especially with, you know, let's bring out the 90-year-old ladies and the 10-year-old girls and getting them talking together about what to be done and how to make a peaceful world would be incredible. Just if nothing happens on a grand scale, at least something would happen for each of those women present at that Congress.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us this morning. That was artist Nikki McClure with us by phone. Thanks, Nikki.
Thank you, and have a good day.
You too. So now, Professor Catherine Antolini of West Virginia Wesleyan College, are you surprised that women of today in 2014 are finding such resonance in this history?
No, not at all. And again, it's just hearing the proclamation again, the irony too, as we talk about the 1914 proclamation, is that during World War I, Mother's Day was such a huge part of the wartime propaganda. So we go from Julia Ward Howe saying, we don't want our sons to die in a battlefield, to the Mother's Day celebrations in 1917 and 1918, celebrating women who sent their sons off to war, and how patriotic you were, and what a great patriotic mother you were by willing to make such a sacrifice. And same thing's going to happen during World War II, where Mother's Day is used to define good motherhood as being willing to sacrifice your son to war instead of fighting against it.
Is there something about, motherhood is about as universal of a theme as there could be. I mean, nobody can exist without some mother figure bringing them into the world. And I wonder if there's just something inherent about anything that universal being also very manipulable.
Yeah, and it's so funny because Anna Jarvis has a quote very similar to that. She's saying everybody has a mother. So this is a holiday she figured would bring everybody together, all races, all creeds, all religions, because no matter how different we are, we have a mother, or we've had women in our lives who have mothered us. And so we know that love. And we can, you know, other holidays may celebrate labor or celebrate war. This is a holiday that we all could know and understand because we've all had this experience of being mothered.
You mentioned earlier that Anna Jarvis, who was the real activist behind the Mother's Day that we celebrate today, that she died impoverished and alone, which is really sad when you think that she spent her life working for other people to be recognized for something that she didn't have. Could you tell us a little bit about what happens between her activism and her sort of sad demise?
It's when the day just has a life of its own, and you have all these, you have the commercial side of it, and you have charitable foundations who use it, and so she just really exerts so much of her fortune and her health and trying to maintain control of it, and she simply can't, and it just wears at her, but she fights. I mean, she was arrested once for disorderly conduct, for crashing a convention of American War Mothers who used Mother's Day as a fundraiser for veterans. She crashed them, and was the charges were dropped because the magistrate in Philadelphia liked her. So
she's a party crasher, though.
She is, and she also crashed a convention of confectioners. If you held a convention in Philadelphia and she did not like you, she's going to make an appearance. And she was in her 50s by that time. So she, you know, will rail and fight and protect. And in 1923, she threatened to sue the governor of New York.
Over what?
He was a part of a committee in New York to have this huge Mother's Day celebration. And she did not, in her view of Mother's Day as intellectual property, she did not authorize this committee. So she was suing them or threatened to sue them for copyright infringement because they were claiming to be associated with her and they weren't. And so, interesting enough, Robert Spiro, who was the man helping to lead this Mother's Day committee in New York, the next year starts a movement to replace Mother's Day with Parents' Day. So she created a rival with this man in New York, and they hated each other for about 40 years, trying to replace Mother's
Just
Day.
Just a short-lived grudge.
Yes. She had she called them anti-mother propagandists. She had a long list of enemies. And she got mad at Eleanor Roosevelt, she got mad at FDR, she got mad at you name it, and she was not afraid to express her disapproval.
Were all of the anti-mother propagandists, as she put it, people who infringed on copyright, or was there ever something with more substance in her objection?
It was copyright. It also interesting, she resented charities, and that's a lot of reasons her problem with Eleanor Roosevelt. In the 1930s, Eleanor Roosevelt supported different kind of charitable foundations. They used Mother's Day for social causes, like, you know, in the midst of the Depression, poor mothers, or better maternal care, maternity care. She was supported foundations who used Mother's Day. And to Anna Jarvis, to her, every mother needed to be praised on Mother's Day, not pitied for being poor.
Ah, so that's her beef with charity.
That's her beef. And she also called them Christian pirates because she wasn't convinced that the money they were collecting was actually going to help anybody but themselves. So she was convinced these charity promoters were just stealing the money anyway. But, you know, she's like, every mother deserves, you know, what mother is poor if you love her? So just one day out of the year, can we not, you know, pity mothers? Do we have to turn Mother's Day into a beggar's day?
Well, Catherine Antolini, how did you become interested in all of this?
I was a graduate student, and I already was interested in the history of motherhood and this idea of motherhood being kind of commercialized. And I was approached by the International Mother's Day Shrine in Grafton to come talk with them. And I go visit this lovely church, which is now this museum, and they had all these documents that were, you know, 100 years old sitting in the basement of their kitchen.
Wow.
I know. I'm like, you can't leave these here. So I volunteered to archive them for them. And it took me a summer, and my only payment or request is that I could photocopy any kind of document that I wanted. So I'm going through these papers, and I'm reading more by Anna Jarvis, and she's like, this woman is just fascinating.
Well, no historian is rich with access to documents.
Right. And so it was just like, how could I pass seeing documents that other historians who've studied Mother's Day have not had access to? So it was just, it was thrilling.
And one last question for you. How do you celebrate Mother's Day?
We go to the shrine, so I'm always a part of the Mother's Day service in Grafton. And I have two boys, and my husband, my two boys, and my mother comes, and we celebrate Mother's Day both as a family, but then also as a community, as part of the overall celebration of the history.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Catherine Antolini, professor at West Virginia Wesleyan College. Excuse me. Thank you so much for speaking to us about the history of Mother's Day, a little known grassroots element of that holiday.
Thank you for having me.
And now we are going to hear something totally different. Why don't you talk to me? Why don't you talk to me? Welcome to our weekly Tell KCUR segment, where we invite Allison Rollitz, our social media producer here at KCUR, to share your answers to a question we've been asking you throughout the week. This week, we have asked you how you're like your mother. And Allison?
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me.
What was the thought behind this question?
Well, Gina, I do a lot of nerdy social media research when we do these questions, and I saw that companies are really hitting you, the audience, really hard on Mother's Day. So many ads, and then so many just questions. A lot of people saying, fill in the blank, I love my mother because blank, or your mom's so awesome because blank. And we just wanted to ask something a little bit more sincere. So we thought by getting people to talk about why they're like their mother might be a little nice introspection and a little flattery for their moms on Mother's Day.
You mentioned introspection, and it's true. I think this question really gets people thinking hard about their relationships, not just their mothers, but their connection with their mothers.
Sure.
So what are some of the things you found out?
Well, we got a lot of really just touching responses, for lack of another word. Susan, for example, she sent this really nice email about her mother who, you know, she was a widow. She had four children, but she was always able to have a beautiful garden on a budget. And so she gardens like her mom. And she's built this garden as a living tribute to her mom. And I'm going to read a little bit from that email. Susan says that her mom, quote, always shared her plants and plants were shared with her. There was an exchange of beauty. Now I love to share my flowers with friends. My mother taught me a garden is as varied and as beautiful as your friends, with wonderful memories each time you see their contribution to your garden.
Aw.
It was really sweet, really sweet. And the question also evoked a lot of emotion for some of our listeners. And I don't think we quite expected that at KCUR. For instance, Sonia was kind enough to tell us about her mother in this phone message.
My mother was adopted, but she was always compassionate. So there is no way you can explain to me why it took 3 weeks for my country to express outrage over the kidnapping of nearly 300 innocent Nigerian girls. I still have my mother's compassion. Thank you.
Oh, there are so many things to latch onto in that message. And it's interesting that she's relating her feelings about her mother to the day's news, much as the women we discussed earlier in the show had done.
Mm-hmm, definitely, definitely. And kind of as you bring up, we did have a lot of women respond to these questions. In fact, most of the responses came from women. But I want to point out, we did have some men chime in, like Jesus. He talked about how he shares his mom's hard work and dedication. He tweeted, "She always taught me to be myself and show compassion toward anyone and make their day." Zach talked about how he shares his mom's desire to be around people, along with her silly humor. But from there, really, the responses really run the gamut. A lot of very individual, unique responses. Mitchell talked about how he got his appreciation for art from his mom. For Deborah, it was her love of chocolate and reading. For Katie, it was the fact that she cries at the most ridiculous things like her mom. And then even Carla, who sent us this very nice, precise tweet about how she corrects her boy's grammar just like her mother did. And by the way, she used the apostrophe correctly, so the grammar was good in her tweet.
Kudos to her.
Kudos to Carla. But the only kind of negative thing that someone shared was Erica, and I'm going to read her tweet. "One day as a tween, I was laughing at my mom's ugly elbows and jokingly stated to her that I hoped I didn't inherit them. But I did."
Well, that's just straight up karma.
It is karma.
When you know, this question got me thinking, and I asked my mom just this morning, actually, how she thought I was like her. And she we had an interesting conversation that concluded with me telling her I think we both give advice better than we receive it. And she said that, well, we see the world as it really is. And I said, but Mom, everyone sees the world as it really is. And she said, but they're wrong and we're right.
Oh, moms. But Gina, you know, as you know, we've got someone sitting in the studio here with us. You weren't the only KCUR employee who responded to this question.
Oh, yes. We have Michael Byers in the studio with us.
What? Is that where I am? Hi.
Hi, Michael. I've really, really loved your tweet. Do you mind if I read it to
sure,
everybody?
Sure.
Remember, we asked everyone, how are you like your mother? And Michael said, "I'd like to think that I inherited Mom's emphasis on good grooming." And you tweeted this lovely photo of your mom picking through your head, almost like a mother of a monkey would. It was really cute. Can you tell us a little bit where that came from?
That was just a little silliness. I took the picture on her birthday, and I was just looking for something that I could share on Facebook and say happy birthday, Mom, to everybody. So this just sort of happened organically, and I'm sitting down on the floor, and she just starts messing with my hair. And I thought, well, this is – and I snapped a picture of it. I thought, well, this is silly and not a little bit embarrassing. And, of course, it would know, of course, I have to post it on Facebook. So
mm-hmm. That's what it's for.
I thought that'd be a nice picture to share for the question that you asked your listeners this week.
Well, Michael, every morning you say good morning to your mother on the air. Can you tell us quickly the story behind that?
The long story short, she's an early riser. She gets up very early. She's been listening to KCUR ever since I started working here, and she likes it when her son says hello to her, and she makes it very clear that she gets upset when I forget. So I try very hard not to.
So every day is Mother's Day for you.
Every single day, as it should be.
Well, Allison Rawlitz, thank you so much for joining us for this week's Tell KCUR. And as always, I'm looking forward to finding out what the question is for our listeners for next week.
Thank you, Gina. And as always, if you're hearing this and you want to chime in on some early Mother's Day love, just tweet us your answer, how you're like your mom, at hashtag Tell KCUR.
That was I'll Always Love My Mama by The Intruders. Before we go, we have a really lovely piece from a local writer that we'd like to share with you. A lot of cliches about motherhood can be incredibly hard to live up to. And to end today's show, we want to hear about how some of those superhuman ideals played in the mind of one woman in the months leading up to her daughter's birth. Liz Tashio told this story at an event last weekend called Listen to Your Mother, where writers and bloggers read stories about motherhood. Let's give it a listen.
Before you were born, you were a fish. When you were a fish, I tried imagining you as a baby, as my baby, but I couldn't. I was 35 years old and nervous. I was afraid I'd get my heart set on you and then lose you to miscarriage. I was also scared that everything would be fine, but that I'd fail you somehow, that I wouldn't be a good mom. For those reasons, I had a massive failure of imagination when it came to you. I felt disconnected from you. I said awkward things while I was pregnant, like, it's the size of a grape. He or she is the size of an apple. Now it's as big as an artichoke. I looked at my growing belly, wondering irrationally if you were really in there, and I remembered having the same feeling standing on the shore of a lake or on the edge of the ocean, looking out at the water, wondering about everything living that I couldn't see, that I couldn't even imagine. While I used metaphors to try to get myself used to the idea of you, I looked forward to mileposts in the pregnancy when I could be sure, at last, that I would imagine you as you, that I would feel what I thought all mothers felt long before their bellies showed, love. Perhaps at the 20-week ultrasound, when I thought the tech would show us your whole little body squirming and swimming, the screen glowing in a dark room, us the quiet underwater fish for once, and you a bundle of stars in the shape of my baby. Instead, she gave us glimpses of white arm bones and leg bones and the braid of a spine and skull as she zipped along your body, measuring and marking, while I lay there hoping to recognize you, to fall in love at last. Then the lights were on and it was over, and on the way home I burst into tears. Perhaps the milestone would be when you started moving. A kick, a punch, a rolling over, my heart would surely move with you. But the best I could do, the most I could feel, was the same mysterious longing I felt while looking at water, wanting to know what was underneath. When I lay on the couch in our living room, my hands on my belly, waiting to feel you move, I was on a boat on the ocean, waiting for a whale to surface, looking so hard my eyes hurt. I was at the lake in childhood, the water brown like tea, schools of tiny minnows shimmering and vanishing at the shoreline. A few weeks before you were born, I was walking in our neighborhood, because walking, even in the August heat, was keeping me in shape for labor, and I felt your foot pushing hard against my side. I pressed back, and you disappeared, that foot darting in, all of you vanishing like a fish. I don't know why, but I laughed, thinking of the delight of huge golden fish in a koi pond, there for a flash, and then gone. I thought, surely, at the moment of your birth, I'd feel a rush of pure love, an instant bonding thanks to the well-timed burst of hormones that biology or God designed to fuse the souls of mothers and babies. I knew mothers who said that happened to them. Their babies, red and crying and squirming, looked like angels to them in that moment. After what felt like forever, you flew out of me in one rush, screaming, with your arms up and your body purple, and your dad put you on my belly and my hands cradled you there. I was saying, hi, hi, over and over, dumb with surprise at the reality of you. I felt an overwhelming urge to protect you, but what I expected, what I thought I would feel, a rush of silly puppy dog love, a certainty that you were the angel I'd been waiting for, even a flash of recognition, it wasn't there. So I gave up waiting. There was far too much to do anyway. The nights and days started rushing together as your dad and I laughed at how little sleep there was to be had living with you. I decided to just start telling you that I loved you without waiting to feel what I thought I was supposed to feel. I love you, baby, I whispered to you when you were red-faced and inconsolable. I love you, I'd croon when you were wriggling your skinny limbs and making yourself impossible to hold. I thought to myself, I'm just going to talk us into crazy love. Experienced parents told me it would happen. Experienced mothers confessed to me they hadn't bonded with their babies early either. All of this helped to know. But what helped the most were two distinct moments in those sleepless first weeks of your life. First, when I cried to a friend, as all mothers should. She listened to me talk about feeling protective of you, feeling endlessly exhausted and endlessly patient, every second of my day turned toward you, but feeling like a failure in terms of loving you enough. That sounds like love to me, she said. Then, one blurry afternoon, you and I were curled up, as we always were, in the nursing chair in the living room, and you were latched on, your tiny light body folded in my arms, your eyes closed, your whole focus on what you were doing. And while I looked down at your face, your eyes opened and you looked up directly at me, and it was like being caught in the gaze of a giant whale, a silent underwater moment, like being seen by another soul. I think I can say now that I didn't know what love was. I don't mean that in the way of pop songs. I mean, I didn't know the many forms love can take. I didn't know that love feels like a surge of patience in the middle of a long night. Love feels like the urge to protect. Love feels like worry over whether I'm being a good mother to you. And when I recognize that love feels all these ways, I know I didn't miss out on what I thought I should feel. I loved you when you were a grape. I loved you when you were an apple. I loved you when you were an artichoke. I loved you when you were a fish.
That was Liz Tascio. She's a local writer, editor, and teacher who serves on the board for The Writer's Place. Visit our website to read the text of Liz's story and to see a photo of Liz with her daughter, who's now 8 months old. To listen back to today's show, go to kcur.org/centralstandard or stay current on Central Standard News by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @kcurcst. Tune in tomorrow as we explore the life of a World War I flying ace. That show will be hosted by Monroe Dodd. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's all for today's Central Standard. Stay tuned for Up to Date Next, and do something nice for your mom this weekend.